sixth case of the day, the United States v. Polak. Mr. Stiller.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Daniel Stiller. I'm the Federal Defender for the Eastern and Western Districts of Wisconsin. And this morning I appear on behalf of Jeffrey Polak. The substance of Mr. Pollack's claim is that when Chief Judge Randa imposed upon him a technically above-guideline sentence of imprisonment, the court's rationale for doing so was incorrect as a matter of both fact and law. While that's the substance of Mr. Pollack's claim, I understand that I arrive here against a circumstantial backdrop that essentially leaves me attempting to push a large procedural rock up a steep Seventh Circuit hill. And that is because Mr. Pollack's plea agreement, entered into with the government, contained a waiver of appellate rights that, if construed as valid, would encompass the substance of the claim I advance today on Mr. Pollack's behalf. The problem, though, is that in the courtroom, during the course of the Rule 11 colloquy attendant to Mr. Pollack's plea of guilty, the district court violated Rule 11B1N by failing to inquire of Mr. Pollack regarding his awareness and understanding of the appellate waiver until after the district court had already accepted Mr. Pollack's guilty plea, found him guilty, and began the process of scheduling the case for sentencing. Rule 11, clearly states that the necessary colloquy, including the inquiry regarding the appellate waiver, must occur prior to the finding of guilt, and that's simply a sensible proposition because these questions are intended to determine whether the client's announced willingness to plead guilty, is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Here, it came after the finding of guilt, and even though Mr. Pollack at that time acknowledged an awareness that the plea agreement contained the waiver, the district court didn't backtrack to ask the fundamental questions. And, sir, understanding that and now having reviewed it with you, is it still your intention and your desire to plead guilty? The district court did not afford Mr. Pollack that opportunity. Where things get further complicated in this case, Your Honors, is that even if I am correct that the district court's noncompliance with Rule 11B1N invalidates the appellate waiver, this court's 2008 opinion in Sura stands for the proposition that any relief that might be available to Mr. Pollack would come only in the form of withdrawal of his guilty plea, which would have to meet its own standard. It's my position, it's Mr. Pollack's desire not to withdraw his guilty plea. It stands on its own merits. It's his desire to have the substance of the district court's sentencing decision reviewed. Sura stands in the way.
So we have to overrule Sura to get to where you want.
That's the big rock in the steep hill, Your Honor. I do believe that there is a basis for concluding that Sura was improperly decided. First of all, were Mr. Pollack sentenced in either the Sixth Circuit or the Ninth Circuit, the issue would simply be whether the appellate waiver is enforceable, and if not, there would be a remand for a resentencing, not a remand for a plea withdrawal. Sura, as I tried to articulate in my reply brief, it's an odd case. It simply states, as a circumstance, and Mr. Sura was an old infirm defendant who was attempting to appeal in the face of an appellate waiver, and as he arrived at the court, all that he hoped to do, like Mr. Pollack, was to get back to the district court for resentencing, not to withdraw the guilty plea. In front of this court, he was told that no, there's a well-established body of Seventh Circuit law that says you can't pick and choose aspects of your plea agreement. As the writing judge in Sura stated, we don't do surgery on plea agreements in this circuit. And that was a simple sentence followed by a citation to three cases. Going to each of those three cases, which were Lockwood, Sisluski, and Whitlow, none of those three cases involved a challenge to the validity of an appellate waiver. Each involved its own unique circumstance in which a defendant was claiming that the appellate waiver shouldn't, for whatever reason, be enforced. In none of those cases was the defendant claiming that the appellate waiver was invalid. That distinguishes Pollack's case from the cases on which Sura relies and places it squarely in the crosshairs of the Sixth Circuit's decision in Murdoch and the Ninth Circuit's decision in, I think it's Arellano-Gallegos.
But you don't have a Seventh Circuit case in which we have performed surgery on a plea agreement where we've upheld part and thrown the rest out.
That's very correct. But I think part of the error in Sura is an oversimplification of things. The overwhelming variety of rights that a defendant gives away in pleading guilty must be given away in order to plead guilty. In other words, the constitutional right to a presumption of innocence cannot stand in the face of a guilty plea. The constitutional right to a jury cannot be maintained in light of a guilty plea. Cross-examination, the right to remain silent, a privilege against self-incrimination, inherent in a guilty plea is the relinquishment of those rights. The statutory right to appeal is different because absent a bargained waiver with a prosecutor, the statutory right of appeal survives a guilty plea, which makes it different than the other panoply of rights that can't be surgically removed from a plea agreement, that can't be excised like an invalid appellate waiver. And in some ways, the posture of this case, and this case wouldn't be unique in this regard, proves somewhat the short-sightedness of the rationale of Sura. If this court were to decide that the only remedy available to Mr. Pollack is to withdraw his guilty plea, and if Mr. Pollack decided that that is what he wished to do in order to have his sentence reviewed, we would all return to Chief Judge Randa in Milwaukee. We would undo a plea agreement that didn't contain a charge bargain or anything of that nature. So we would either revisit and obtain a different modified plea agreement from the government that allows review of sentence, or we would plead in the absence of an agreement, and we would get to the resentencing that Mr. Pollack has always wanted. So in that regard, when Sura sort of makes this naked assertion that an invalid appellate waiver can't be excised from a plea agreement, it's somewhat short-sighted in terms of the judicial interest in conserving resources. If all a defendant is hoping to do is have his sentence reviewed, and if there are grounds for that, allow that and that alone to happen rather than go forth with the charade of we're going to undo a plea agreement to go back to square one to get to the very briar patch that the defendant was asking the court to send him to in the first place. As to the merits, you know, if I've pushed the big rock far enough up the steep hill such that the court gets to the merits of Mr. Pollack's point, the issue is that under circumstances in which Mr. Pollack's advisory guideline sentencing range was a term of imprisonment of 6 to 12 months.
Let me just go back for a minute on this Rule 11. And it was in paragraph 32, the appellate waiver. And the prosecutor caught it after the fact, as you point out. And I guess I'm a little frustrated because I don't understand why there's not a checklist that you don't have. So the court, before the court accepts the plea, you don't say, well, you know, you didn't hit paragraph 32, Judge, about the plea waiver, or the government doesn't have it. It's just a little frustrating when it's all laid out under Rule 11. It's in the bench book by the court. Guilty pleas are taken many, many times. I know you've taken many. You know why we still end up with cases where questions like this are not asked?
Yes, and the irony here is perhaps greater than Your Honor understands from the briefing. Sura was an appeal out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin from Chief Judge Randa's courtroom.
I know that.
Yeah.
I know that. And I'm just saying, it seems to me everybody has an obligation. The district judge, the defense counsel, and the prosecutor. And there's a little checklist that you should check every time the court hits a right. And when the court doesn't hit the right, somebody should say, you didn't hit this, Judge. Can you advise him of paragraph 32? I mean, we just get so many Rule 11 complaints and violations. I just really, it's a little frustrating. And I realize we don't live in a perfect world, but that's why we have checklists.
It sounds as though those of us down here today from the Eastern District of Wisconsin have several messages to take north with us at the end of the day. I see
now,
that I'm...
Now, counsel, Mr. Stiller, was with Mr. Pollack at all times, right?
I personally was.
Right.
He was represented, and it was me.
Right. And So the appropriate language is added after the plea, right?
After the defendant is found guilty, yes.
So the issue is whether that temporal aspect of it is a technical or not so technical violation of Rule 11. What substantial right has been forfeited by the scenario that occurred below? Since you were there with him, I assume you were comfortable that he accepted the language that should have been at the front end of completely at the front end. I mean, that's the heart of the
yes.
case.
Yes. The substantial right that would have been infringed is that by the irregular procedure used by Chief Judge Randa, Mr. Pollack was never given the opportunity during his plea colloquy to say, oh, now that I understand that by pleading guilty I not only give up my right to appeal things known but also future events unknown, I either wish to speak further with my counsel, I want an adjournment, or I want to back out.
Well, but he certainly had an opportunity to confer with you or you with him about withdrawing the plea at that point, didn't you? I mean, now that the complete package, though fractured in the sense that it's post and pre sentencing, it does seem to me we've got a situation where it's sort of a gotcha, isn't it? I mean,
I understand Your Honor's point.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm trying to think down the road. I hope we don't have this again. I share, and, you know, you've got three former district judges here, and that checklist is a great idea. I appreciate sometimes it's hard to remind the judge that he or she has, skipped something.
Yes.
But in this case, it does strike me that you've got able counsel next to a defendant. I can see where there might be additional reflection now on the plea because of this new information that he's entitled to. It doesn't seem at that moment... It ought to be counsel's position that, hey, Judge, I want to talk to, because we're in this what I call fractured situation on the plea.
Yeah, I agree. And though it's not part of the record, I offer it for what it's worth. Quite frankly, until Mr. Koenig, counsel for the government, brought the appellate waiver to Judge Randa's attention, between the time that the plea was signed and the time that it was entered, it had slipped my mind that the plea agreement in this particular case, unlike the majority of cases, did contain the waiver.
But then he counsel does, to his credit, Mr. Pollack realizes that there's something missing. The court then questions him and says, you've gone over that with Mr. Stiller, your attorney? Yes, I have. And, so at that point, if you were uncomfortable, you could have said, and Judge, could you please ask him, now that he's done the plea and this has come out, that he still wants to plead guilty? I mean, I recognize, as Judge Flom says, you know, we have to be sensitive to judges and how they take suggestions. But, I mean, this is your record. This is your client. I don't get it. I mean, you could have said something right then if you thought more needed to be said.
Without a doubt, I could have, and in hindsight, should have. But I think for purposes of this appeal, we can't lose sight of the fact that the Rule 11 colloquy is the court's to conduct. And so while I may have come up short and others may have come up short, for this court's legal consideration, the inquiry is whether the court's colloquy was adequate.
But it's really belt and suspenders, because that plea agreement had that waiver in it and all of the Rule 11 requirements, and you went any... good lawyer would go over that with his clients before the client signed it, I would think.
Correct, as a matter of practice.
I know the rule does require the judge to do it, but it's about the third time probably the defendant's heard that.
In practice, yes.
I might not have heard for both the counsel for the government and defense to just say, let's start this again. Mm-hmm. Especially since, as you say, there's a little irony since this vignette has played out.
And Sir was even referenced, not named, as counsel for the government brought it to Judge Randa's attention.
Well, thank you.
With that, thank you.
Yeah, we'll give you some time for rebuttal. You had a lot of questions. Mr. Koenig.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States of America this morning. I would like to begin by responding to Judge Williams' observation about checklists and not living in a perfect world. I found it very interesting in reviewing some of the cases from other circuits to prepare for today that in other jurisdictions the prosecutor seems to have much more of a speaking role at change of plea hearings than we do in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. As you'll note from reading the transcript, I did have to interrupt the district judge to bring this matter to his attention, and I did so at the earliest possible opening. So I did want to make that practical observation.
And I appreciate that counsel having to be sensitive. I mean, and as Judge Plum said, we're all former district judges, and not that this carries the day, and I understand this isn't the issue before us, but at the end of every plea, I always said to each side, is there anything I've missed? Is there anything else, counsel, to give counsel an opportunity so that if there was something I missed, we could go over it? I realize that's an individual practice and not something that everybody engages in, but it's just frustrating when I'm appreciative of the fact that it was raised, and, you know, in my view, since it was spelled out in the plea agreement and the colloquy that followed, you've gone over it with Mr. Stiller, more could have been said, but I certainly think, at least I'm not troubled, I think there's enough there. But I appreciate your position.
Well, turning to the substance, this Court has long recognized, of course, that plea agreements are very important in the criminal justice system. In the Akinsola case, the Court observed that for that reason it's of vital importance to the system of criminal justice that guilty pleas not be lightly set aside on fanciful arguments that exalt form over substance. And with respect to Mr. Stiller, who's a very able and gracious opponent, I do think that some of the arguments here are somewhat fanciful, or at least insubstantial. There was not plain error associated with the colloquy here for the reason that, unlike Sura and some of the other cases cited by Mr. Stiller, there was a colloquy in this case. It just occurred several moments too late. So while I would concede that there was error and that it was plain, the third and fourth elements of the plain error test are not met in this case. Certainly this would not be the kind of error that would seriously affect the fairness and integrity of the judicial proceedings. On the question of remedy, the appellant's reply brief relies heavily on the Murdoch and Arellano-Gallegos decisions from the Sixth and Ninth Circuits, respectively. I would note that both of those cases, like Sura and unlike this case, involved a, quote, wholesale omission of a colloquy related to the appeal waiver. The defendant argues that he should be allowed to accept parts of the plea agreement piecemeal while escaping the consequences of other parts of the agreement. The law in this circuit has consistently held that that surgical approach should not be allowed, and I think there are good reasons for that, mostly just fairness to all of the parties to the contract, including the government. Again, I would refer back to my observations at the very beginning of my remarks. There's no argument here that the government ought to be punished for overlooking something. And so the government should receive the benefit of the bargain.
Did this defendant have a prior record?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Indeed, he did. In fact, I believe he scored as a Category 6 under the guidelines. Well, in short, Your Honors, we believe the appeal should be dismissed on the basis of the appeal waiver or, in the alternative, that the plea ought to be vacated. So unless there are any further questions, I will rest on my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Koenig. Mr. Stiller, your time has expired, but you may have 2 minutes. You had a lot of questions.
Your Honors, absent further questions from the court, I'll wait.
All right. Apparently not. Thank you both. The case is taken under advisement and